This podcast is intended for UK and Ireland healthcare professionals only. It is my pleasure to welcome you to Series 2 and Episode 4 of the Interstitial Lung Disease Academy Spotlight Podcasts, brought to you by Boehringer Ingelheim. Featuring prominent members of the UK and Ireland ILD community, these podcasts hope to shine a spotlight on the great work being done around the country and break down some of the challenges facing us in delivering excellent care to our patients. My name is Dr. Anne-Marie Russell, a clinical academic at the University of Exeter Respiratory Institute and Royal Devon University NHS Foundation Trust. I have a special interest in patient-reported measures and outcomes in interstitial lung disease and patient-centred approaches. Joining me on today's episode is Dr. Michael Gibbons, who is the Clinical Director for the Southwest Peninsula Interstitial Lung Disease Service and Respiratory Consultant at Royal Devon University Healthcare NHS Trust. He is also an Honorary Associate Professor at the University of Exeter and a Principal Investigator for a number of studies, including those relating to interstitial lung diseases. Welcome, Michael.
Good morning, Anne-Marie.
So I wonder, Michael, if I could start by asking you a little bit about you and your current diverse portfolio of clinical practice, clinical leadership and research.
Thanks, Anne-Marie. So first and foremost, I'm a consultant respiratory physician. So I trained in respiratory medicine, but my strong focus is in interstitial lung disease. That's where I spend most of my practice. So linked to that, I'm the clinical director of the Southwest Peninsula Interstitial Lung Disease Network. So that serves the peninsula of the Southwest, but also extends into Somerset and into parts of Dorset. So I lead that with the team. It's a diverse team, and we make sure that all members of that team, be it physios, pharmacists, nurses, fellows, are actively involved in that team. And I'm sure we're going to talk about that in a bit more detail today. I'm also the clinical director of the clinical research network within the Southwest Peninsula. So that's the NIHR delivery arm. So I oversee all clinical trials and clinical research studies for all specialty areas for our region. And then I have an honorary contract within the University of Exeter, and that's linked to my work mainly in interstitial lung disease. So I have a fairly diverse portfolio, so I'm interested in all aspects of interstitial lung disease from right back to the bench, so genetics, and molecular and cellular biology, and then increasingly, recently, more into the more translational aspects, patient-centered care, drug interventions, and how we can really develop interstitial lung disease at many levels. And then, at the end of that spectrum, I also am a PI in clinical trials and am a member of a variety of consortia where we're trying to develop new therapies, so investigator-initiated studies, clinical trials in interstitial lung disease.
Yeah, so an incredibly rich portfolio and diverse, but I think probably quite valuable in bringing together those worlds of clinical research and patient care and having oversight of that at a regional level. And I suppose that leads in quite nicely, thinking about that holistic view. I know that you have a commitment to delivering holistic approaches to the management of patients in your clinical service. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about that, Michael, and how that works.
Yeah, so I think it really goes back, probably, Anne-Marie, to when I first was appointed as a consultant in interstitial lung disease. And at that point, there were no antifibrotic medications around, and the care of patients with interstitial lung disease was very poor and remains in need of improvement. So I've got a strong focus on the patient aspect. So back then, I reached out and worked very closely with the British Lung Foundation at that time, who were only charity, and really about trying to push the patient agenda. And then what came out of that was that we set up one of the first support groups for pulmonary fibrosis in Exeter, which has now become a regional group linked to action pulmonary fibrosis directly. So working with patients and with charities, I think what that really educated me in was there was a real need to make this a holistic approach to how we manage our patients. So actively working with our patients in partnership to drive the needs of that patient cohort group, and then to link in with the various stakeholders to make that happen. So that's been a long journey, an endeavour of mine. And as we go along, we know we are constantly working with the patients to refine what they need, and then trying to implement that into NHS structures.
And you mentioned before the sort of commitment to person-centred care, and I guess within that, strategies to optimise holistic care have to be offset against actually managing the throughput of patients, which is steadily increasing, and I guess balancing that with the cost effectiveness of the care we deliver as well. So I wonder, Michael, if you could maybe tell us ways in which you're working to achieve this and sort of strike that balance between good holistic patient care that is cost effectiveness, and I guess that to some extent might tap into your leadership roles as well.
Yeah, so thanks, Anne-Marie. This all started with the doctor nurse relationship, so the ILD consultant and the ILD nurse specialist, and then as time's gone on, we've expanded that. So what's become apparent to me, I think, is that it's a need to have an ILD pharmacist linked as part of that team, where you have instant access to that experience of drugs and side effects that can really, really enhance the experience and education for the patients. We do have within our team ILD nurse specialists who are non-medical prescribers who work with the pharmacists. So that works in close harmony. But many centres might not have nurse specialists with that expertise. I think a pharmacist is an invaluable addition to the team. And within our clinic, we have pharmacists that participate in meeting our patients. And then the other aspect is physiotherapy in terms of symptom management. They bring a wealth of experience and time, which they can use to good effect to support that education of the patients, and then enable follow-up. And having these members within the team is good for everybody. It's good for the patient first and foremost. It's good for the development of the pharmacists, the physios, the nurses, and really, really expands, if you like, it expands the reach of interstitial lung disease through all the healthcare professional groups, which is important for patients fundamentally, because you have more interested healthcare professionals, which then feeds back into patient care. I think it's probably important to mention the admin members of our team as well. So we have an ILD coordinator who's soon to become our ILD manager. And she has a role in working with our patients, be that through the patient support group that we have within the region, or in actually being the first port of call to contacting these patients who may be waiting to see us, to put their fears at ease, to send them advanced information so that they know what's going on, because there's nothing worse than waiting to be seen at a hospital appointment and having no information of when that might be. So following feedback from patients and part of our learning, we really, really change the service that's to meet all of the aspects of the patient's needs right along that pathway. So even from the point where they've not seen us to where they have come to see us, and then after that. And then obviously, you know, money is important within the NHS, and there are cost savings potentially by involving these healthcare professionals. It means that we can increase the throughput of patients being seen, because they might need to spend less time with a consultant. So the traditional model, you know, what I used to do many years ago was have to go through all of these aspects myself in a consultation, which was quite rushed. But now, having all of these strands within the team, we can enhance the patient experience. But actually, it means that you reduce consultant time, and therefore save money and get more patients through the system with an enhanced experience.
I mean, that sounds fantastic. And I think picking up on your point, you know, communication is key, and often patients can have excellent care at the point of presentation. But if that communication doesn't happen in a timely manner, pre and post appointment, it leads to a lot of stress. So that sounds like a fantastic role, and something other people in other centres listening to this podcast would be keen to emulate. So it sounds like a really diverse team. And I'm just wondering, a bit of a cheeky question really, is who you think might be missing from that team, and in an ideal world, who else you might want to bring in?
I mean, so what I haven't mentioned that actually does come to the clinic is the members of the research team. We have researchers come, and they like to be there. They like the patient to meet the patients and to explain the study to them. So we have active members of the research team. We also have then other healthcare professionals. So within the clinical research facility, the members of their team come down. What I'd really like to have would be a dietitian. I think a dietitian would almost certainly add value to those consultations. We have experimented over the years as to how we might support the mental health component of those clinics, be that through psychology support or psychiatry support, or through psychiatric liaison nursing team support. And I think that's an area probably in need of development, because the needs of the patients are different at different points in the journey, and at the first consultation it might be too much to have members of the psychiatric team there, but I'm open to exploring that. I think dietetic members certainly are important to have there. I'd love to have members of the clinical trials team there as well, to talk about the clinical trials. But I think what we're learning, Anne-Marie, is, as you know, is that there is a balance between having all members of healthcare professionals there you think the patient needs, with overloading the patient. So this is an evolution in our journey working with our patients. So I think there comes a balance between having everybody there you think they need to help them, and then maybe phasing that over a period of time, and we're still working our way through that.
Yeah. No, fantastic. We'll sort of watch this space as that develops. And I suppose that leads in quite nicely to think about that interdisciplinary team in involvement. I think the multidisciplinary team model is very well established in interstitial lung disease, focused around diagnosis, and absolutely there is a place for that interdisciplinary team, but it is evolving. And maybe part of that is thinking about supporting patients to self-manage. And the pandemic has taught us perhaps more than anything that it's good to keep patients at home and away from a hospital setting if we can. So I wonder if you could tell us about how you might be integrating some of those supported self-management approaches to patient care, and what the benefits of that might be.
Yeah, so we've got an excellent member of our self-supported management group, yourself, who leads on that. So it's important to have an international leader. It's important to have someone within the team who has a real interest and hunger to take that forward, which we have locally, which is fantastic. And then listening to the patients and linking with new technologies as they come through is important. So we did, you know, we used variety of techniques for patients during the pandemic, and what we learned was that actually every patient's different, and every patient's needs and requests are slightly different. But what would be useful would be to have a suite of opportunities for the patient. One of the opportunities which we are working very hard to develop is home spirometry. And as you know, home spirometry, it feels like something that the patients would want. It's not for everyone. We're learning that. Many patients like to come and have regular contact and see their consultant and their nurse specialist and other members of the team. But some patients are very happy to monitor their condition with home spirometry. And the potential benefits to that, as you've alluded to, are that patients can be at home, so they don't have to come to hospital on a regular basis. What that also allows is it reduces the need to come to hospital, find parking space, all the costs that incurs. It helps with the carbon footprint because there's less travel for patients, and reduces the kind of stress of coming to a hospital consultation. And from the NHS's perspective, if you have less visits per patient, then that reduces, if you like, the number of consultations. So we're moving within that area of home spirometry into patient-initiated follow-up, where we can be responsive to the needs of patients rather than relying on the traditional model where you see them at a four-month or six-month interval and nothing happens in between, and you find that you've lost a couple of months because the patient didn't tell you there was a problem, or they've tried to get into the system and couldn't get in. So we're moving very much to this patient-initiated follow-up, and we're starting using home spirometry as our first technological advance. But I'm sure as time goes on, that suite of technology will evolve, and there'll be many more opportunities for patients to self-manage through a variety of ways. And then we will develop the service as need be.
And I'm guessing that's really important in the Southwest Peninsula, because it's a huge region, and there's, I guess, a lot of rural communities that may struggle with some of the transport infrastructure. So I just wondered how that works across a diverse region, and whether you think this approach is translatable to other areas in the UK.
Oh, absolutely. What we're finding is that patients like the idea. They need to have a smartphone, or we give them an iPad if they don't have one. But there's certainly an opportunity for that. You know, we all have patients in the UK where we may have patients are 2.5 hours away from the specialist centre, and to have the ability to remotely monitoring them, to have the ability to remotely connect with them, to talk to them. In many ways, that should increase the efficiency of the ability to see patients, because if you just have a lot of patients being seen on a regular basis, the flexibility in which you can respond to patients' needs gets diluted. So this will definitely help with that, and it will expand our reach, as you say, so that we can provide access to the patients we need in a geographically dispersed area with enhanced efficiency.
And in terms of having access to the specific devices, is that available for all patients, Michael? Or do patients have to buy any of these devices themselves?
So the home spirometry, they could purchase that themselves. We are currently working in partnership with a company, and we have funding from NHSX. So the patients aren't paying for the home spirometers currently. The prices are coming down considerably as time evolves. They do need to have a smartphone in the majority, but for patients that don't have smartphones, we do have a limited number of iPads or tablets or devices that can link into that. So we're trying to do it in a way that where the patients don't have to pay. But you know, what I'm finding increasingly is that there are patients that actually want to be more in control of their health, and they would rather purchase the devices themselves and choose whatever they want, as long as the technology enables that. So again, you know, we may assume that we should be providing everything for the patients for free, but actually some patients would prefer the choice of having their own device so they can link that to other aspects of their life, of which health is just one component.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. And I think certainly attitudes to technology have probably changed over the last couple of years for all of us. We're used to communicating in different ways. And so I'm thinking that with this patient-initiated follow-up model of care, do you think that the interdisciplinary team are essential to make that work? And in terms of a burden of contact, do you have a feel for whether how different that is to a traditional approach?
So absolutely, Anne-Marie. I think the interdisciplinary approach is the way forward. To make that work, you need to have an interdisciplinary team which works together, which is cohesive. And as time goes on, to build the skill set and confidence within that interdisciplinary team. What we're about to introduce into our ILD team is a band 4 healthcare practitioner who will be clinically trained. So they will be able to have a patient facing role with clinical training, which will offset the need for patients to be seen by the consultant, by the nurse specialist, or by the pharmacist. So in many ways, it's a first port of call within that journey. And as long as they have knowledge to put the patients at ease and to escalate appropriately, then we've always got to be careful that the patient doesn't feel they've been fobbed off by someone who's triaging them. And we've got to make sure that the initial point of contact is by someone who is supportive and can deal with their needs, and then feed it through the interdisciplinary team as needed. And I think having that ladder of access allows for more patients to have the opportunity to link with us, rather than the traditional model where patient phones nurse specialists, and then nurse specialists may or may not need to speak to the consultant. We have patient comes into the system, and then they can be directed to the pharmacist, to the nurse specialist, to the physio, to the consultant, to the dietitian, to the research team, to the psychiatry and mental health team, depending upon their specific needs.
Yeah, so it's possible to have a much more individualised approach to that patient's pathway of care.
Absolutely.
And I guess that leads me on to think about other sort of fibrotic lung diseases, perhaps as an example, connective tissue disease related ILDs, and how do you manage with across such a large region in terms of cross speciality collaboration? So, for example, is it feasible? Is it possible to engage with rheumatologists for the management of interstitial lung disease patients with pulmonary fibrosis?
Yes, absolutely. And I think the key to all this is obviously relationship building. So I've been building relationships with my rheumatology colleagues across the region for many years, and that allows me to be responsive to their needs. Many of my rheumatology colleagues, they like the autonomy to manage their patients and to ask for help when needed. Some like to work much more in collaboration. So I kind of try and support my colleagues in a way that is in keeping with what their needs are. So I had an MDT with a group of rheumatologists from South Devon earlier this week, because that's the approach they would like. So we can definitely work in partnership with our rheumatology colleagues. I don't think it necessarily needs to be a rheumatology ILD clinic. I think clinicians have a wide spectrum of interests, expertise, and needs. And I feel my job is to try and be as responsive to their needs, because ultimately that then increases the efficiency in which I can work with them, which is better for patient care. So it's moving away slightly from the traditional model where you have a rheumatologist and a consultant in a clinic, because that might not be possible. How can we be more responsive? So in many ways, this is a bit like clinician-initiated follow-up to support the patient-initiated follow-up.
Yeah, no, fantastic. Thank you. And so you mentioned before the importance of integrating research professionals into the clinic, or possibly in a different format, so that patients feel connected and have the opportunity to participate in research. Given your honorary contract with the university and the kind of development of close working relationships between university and NHS trusts, are there any developments in the pipeline, or anything particular about Exeter and team working that you think is a model that other people could learn from?
Well, we the way that we have developed, and the we is the whole team, is that we are very much have a flat structure. So there is not a lead as such. We are all leaders working together. So and that you know goes across the scientists, the clinicians, and then within the clinicians we have, as you know, a whole bunch of people. So we have medics, nurses, we have physiologists, we have some dietitians. And some physiotherapists, and everyone has an equal voice. So I think that we feel that certainly that model is the most productive. It's a collaborative model. It's an everyone has an equal voice model. And I think that breeds harmony within the group, and it leads to a much more productive, effective and happy group.
Yeah, and I have to say, having come to work with you in the Southwest, I think someone once told me there is no I in team, and I certainly experienced that. I think it is a very strong collaborative effort, and every voice, including the patient's voice, is heard. So it is a fantastic service, and one that continues to evolve. So thank you very much, Michael, for your time today, and we look forward to looking at the evaluations from the Home Spirometry Programme as well. Thank you.
It's my great pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity to chat to you today.